Now I'm joined on the line by Duncan Graham. He is Managing Director of Retail Excellence. Duncan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara.
You and colleagues appeared before the Oireachtas Committee on Enterprise, Trade and Employment today, and one of the key pillars of that deputation was the call for a 50% rent amnesty for the first 4 months of this year. What kind of a difference would that make to your members?
I think it would make a huge difference. I know there's a lot of positive talk over the last few weeks about how the retail industry has performed since it reopened, what, about 6 weeks ago now. And that's true. You know, it has certainly been a bit of a buoyant few weeks, certainly the start of it. But, you know, that's coming on the back of a lot of pent-up demand, a lot of squirreled away income and savings that people have had. And our concern is that that's not going to continue. And, you know, we are going to get to a situation come August, September, when footfall in our towns and cities will drop off. We're already seeing that in terms of our cities around the country. You know, and retailers are being left at the moment with demands on rent for periods of closure. And, you know, if you consider that a lot of non-essential retailers were closed for 9 out of the last 15 months, it's simply unsustainable to be able to foot a bill of 100% of rent for that period of time. So we're really just looking for burden sharing and something that's fair and reasonable, Ciara.
I imagine that the buoyancy to which you've referred, Duncan, is patchy at best across the country. Some city centre areas may be really, really feeling the want of office workers, of tourists. Some retailers in smaller towns and villages could have people out the door, but there's only so buoyant can be to make up for 9 months of closure.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, this footfall is extremely patchy. And, you know, what was very evident when we first opened up was the shopping centres in particular were performing well. You know, there was no doubt that footfall was there. And, of course, it's all masked by the fact that people had money in their pocket. So they were going in, they were spending on items that they'd been perhaps, you know, needing to spend on for the 4 or 5 months previously. You know, but that was actually masking the lower footfall in city centres. Mm. So if you take Dublin, for example, you know, the numbers in terms of footfall are still around 30 or 40% down on what you'd normally see pre-pandemic. So, you know, and when you've not got the tourist industry at this time of the year, I mean, literally there are no foreign tourists around the island at the moment, when you've not got people working in offices around the city centre, and when you've not got hospitality working hand in glove with retail, you know, you really feel it. And certainly, you know, the retail industry is by no means where it was 2 years ago. It's changed irreversibly now at this point and needs ongoing support.
In terms of your request for that 50% amnesty for the first 4 months of this year, how did the request go down and how do you imagine that it will work in practical terms should it proceed?
So I think there's probably a couple of things here. I think when we're talking to members of the Oireachtas, it went down well. I think we got a sympathetic hearing. I think there's no doubt that you know, people are very much aware of the issues that have faced the industry. In terms of how this is going to work going forward, I think, look, most of this 50% off or this rent amnesty is really aimed at landlords. Mm. And as I say, we're not saying that we should be, you know, that we should be looking for complete rent write-offs for this period of time, even though in many cases no money was made or taken. What we are saying is that there should be some burden sharing, and that just goes to the banks as well. You know, clearly the landlords are also beholden to the banks in many cases. So, you know, somewhere along the line there needs to be a practical approach here, and one of the things that we've certainly suggested to government is that there needs to be a more formalised mediation process to avoid these issues ending up in the courts, because once something ends up in the courts, it's going to cost everybody money and it's going to result in continued closures, and that's not good for anybody in this case.
Isn't it the banks that you need to get on board more than the landlords, because it is the banks to whom most landlords are beholden? We have seen very famously the owners of Georgia Street Arcade forgive their tenants all rents essentially since the start of the pandemic because they were in the financial position to do so. Many landlords just are not.
Yeah, and it is, and certainly we're not, you know, we're not keeping the banks out of this by any means. We do feel that the banks have their part to play, and it's great. You know, that issue that you've got of George's Arcade is a great example of where they've got the money to be able to do that. And you know, it's going to be certainly horses for courses, and certainly, you know, we also feel that a lot of the institutional landlords, a lot of those that are linked back to various pension funds, often out of the country, you know, have got the ability to be able to do this. In fact, the reality of it is that very often what we see, where we see deals are being made, is with private landlords, you know, where you can actually get round the table. And that's the key to this. It's the collaborative working. It's the getting round the table. It's everybody agreeing that there's a problem. Everybody, you know, being open and upfront as to what they want out of the solution and finding a way forward. And that, the reality of that is mediation. And that's the sort of thing that we feel is needed in order to get us beyond this next step and into some form of normality again.
What happens from here following that presentation, Duncan?
So, look, it's difficult to tell. I think the Joint Committee were very responsive. I think, you know, we've raised this issue big time now on a number of occasions with government. And I think that, you know, the ball is really now in the government's hands, insofar as the only thing really that they've done throughout the pandemic to resolve this issue is introduce a code of conduct, a voluntary code of conduct in this case, that was brought into place in September of last year. Now, you know, there's been stony silence since that from government, and they've really said, look, this is a matter between landlords and tenants. Well, really, we just need them to start asking some questions now. We need them to start suggesting, you know, what the Tornister has actually said to us privately, which is, you know, that this can't, the burden of this cannot all fall to the retailer. There needs to be some form of burden sharing. We just need the government to raise this and to start, you know, bringing people's attention to it in the same way that we are.
Duncan Graham, Managing Director of Retail Excellence, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, the new National Children's Hospital Development Board has been appearing today before the Oireachtas Health Committee, and it has admitted that the costs for the project are set to increase beyond the current estimate of an absolutely staggering €1.4 billion. I'm joined on the line now by David Cullinan. He's Sinn Féin's health spokesperson, but also is a member of the Oireachtas Health Committee. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
That it would take one's breath away to imagine that a building of the size, scale and purpose envisaged by the new National Children's Hospital was cost $1.4 billion in the first instance, much less exceed that.
Well, listen, I think people have come accustomed at this stage to the staggering cost of the National Children's Hospital. It is without doubt one of the most expensive hospitals ever built in the world, if not the most expensive. And every time we try and get some sort of reasonable estimation of what the final cost will be, it goes up and it goes up. So we know the most recent cost was €1.433 billion. That's how much has been committed by government. But we also know that last year when the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board were before the Health Committee, they said there was 600 outstanding claims, and that's disputes between the actual the contractor and the board itself, and that those outstanding claims, if they had to be settled, amounted to a minimum of €200 million. What we learned today is that 600 has become 900, and of the 600, only a handful, less than five, have actually been resolved, and those five that have been resolved have cost us an extra €2.5 million. So if you look and judge those five and the cost of €2.5 million against the nearly 900 which are still outstanding, and those disputes have in fact been parked until the end of the project, so they've decided between them that they will park the disputes and deal with them at the very end, shows that we're looking at least, I would say, €200 million more, if not more than that, on top of the €1.4 billion.
Is that parking normal practice?
No, it isn't, and there was a process that was agreed at the very early stages of this process. So it's a dispute mechanism process that allows for the developer or the contractor to make a claim, and then there is an adjudicator and a process that allows for mediation, and then if there isn't, there's an adjudication. If there isn't an agreement, it's an adjudication, and then if that doesn't resolve, it goes to court. What they've agreed is that they will park this process. In other words, they will still allow the claims to be made. They will still go through the process up to the point where it gets to mediation or gets form of action, and then it's simply parked. So we now have essentially 900 claims or disputes between the board and the contractor that will sit there. They'll come back to them, as the chair of the board said today, at the end of the project, try and resolve them. But we have no indication as to how much additional liability that will involve for the state. And what we do know is that it's already a staggering 1.4 billion, add a couple of hundred more million to it at the very least, and I think that's what we're looking for. And it's been said for some time that we probably won't get much change out of 2 billion euro for the hospital at this point.
Now, what kinds of things are we talking about in these claims? Because I'm sure there's a spectrum of experience here, from lower order to quite a high level of gravity.
In terms of the claims,
yeah.
Well, the substantive claims actually come about because of the way the contract was initially put together. So it was a contract that was didn't include the design, and it was one of these contracts that's very rarely used by the public service, so it was a new type of contract, and essentially the actual design of the buildings themselves was not part of the actual costings. And that's like, you know, unforeseen things can happen. It's only when you go into the actual design and you come across archaeological problems, or you come across structural problems, or you come across difficulties in other areas as well, do costs escalate. So it's known in any big infrastructural project, the actual design of them in terms of what happens on the ground, you know, is going to add significant costs. So the fact that it was the two-tier nature of the contract, and the fact that they more or less just costed the shell as opposed to the actual design, is in reality why we're seeing these rising and mounting costs. But there was also no fixed cost, which meant that we have these ongoing claims, ongoing disputes. So week after week, we have new claims of additional costs being submitted by the contractor. All have to go through this very convoluted mediation process and dispute mechanism process. And for that reason, I think because there were so many claims, they've just decided to park them and deal with them at the end. But it doesn't mean that they're dealt with. It means they're simply parked. And at a time when they do get to deal with them, it's estimated that the additional costs arising from those would be quite significant.
Who authorised or commissioned, David, the use of that new type of contract?
That would have been the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, and also the Department of Health at the time. So it was there was a lot of controversy around that contract at a time when it first came to light that there were significant additional costs. And it was said at that point it was an unusual type of contract, and I think accepted by the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform that it's a type of contract that they wouldn't be looking at again. So it would make sense, and certainly should have made sense then, that when you're spending big amounts of money and you have a project of this scale, that you want to make sure that your costs are estimated as best as you can, and that whatever type of contract is put in place, you're putting an obligation on the contractor to come back with the design, with the fit-out, with the building, with any potential mitigating cost that might come up. There's always going to be some element of additional cost.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes underspent, which is very rare, but certainly shouldn't be anything like it is. And bear in mind, the initial cost of this was 300 million. It went to 500 million, 700 million, a billion, 1.1 billion, now 1.4 billion, and potentially the final cost could be anything up to 2 billion euros. So it just seems to be rising and rising and escalating and escalating. And what's frustrating is we still actually don't know what the final cost will be.
And I know the CEO of the Development Board, David Gunning, appeared before you and your colleagues in the Oireachtas Health Committee today. He declined to give a final cost, arguing any public statement would prejudice ongoing talks with the builder regarding costs. Is that an acceptable statement to you?
No, because it was 8 months ago when Mr. Gunning and his team were last before the Oireachtas Health Committee. And what he had said to us on that occasion, because back then there was a frustration from the members that we weren't able to get answers to two key issues: when the hospital will be built and opened, and how much the final cost will be. What he had indicated at that point is that they would be in a position to come back, as he put it, in the early stages of this year, in the first quarter of this year. So we gave plenty of time to the board to solve whatever issues were there. We left it until July, so it's 8 months, certainly 9 months, since they were last before the health committee. And even today, we were back to the square one, Groundhog Day, where it was the same response. I can't answer the question, so my prejudice any discussions or negotiations we have with the contractors, and that might be the case. The problem is, why is it taking so long to resolve all of these issues? So there's obviously a lot of conflict between the developers and the board, but it all goes back to what I was saying earlier, the nature of the contract. Mm. But not even to be able to give us an estimate of what the cost would be, and in fact even the figure of 900 claims, none of that information was in their opening statement. Again, it had to be dragged out of the board, where you know we knew there were 600 claims, it's now 900 claims, but we don't know the full cost. But we know that the estimated cost of potentially resolving the 600 claims was about 200 million. So I would imagine we're talking, if you were to resolve these 900 claims, anything up to 300 million euro or more. And obviously the board will say they will defend themselves against these claims and may well win some of those judgments, but we are talking about significant money. And the other element of it is the actual timeline. So it was due to be completed in August 2022. The new completion date is December 2023, and they're now saying that best case scenario, the hospital will be open in the latter end of 2024 at best, and I think that's optimistic. We could be looking at 2025. So not only is it the most expensive hospital ever built, it's the longest running hospital in terms of how long it has taken to build it and to equip it. Now obviously COVID has played an impact and a role in that as well, I accept that, but the issues dogging this particular project precede COVID, that's for sure.
David Cullinan, Sinn Féin's health spokesperson and indeed a member of the Oireachtas Health Committee, which heard from the board of the new National Children's Hospital today. Thank you indeed for joining us. A school in Scotland has removed two books from its second level school curriculums, To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men. I know To Kill a Mockingbird is certainly on the second level curriculum in Ireland. I'm not sure about Of Mice and Men, but I think it certainly has been in the recent past. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Eben Joseph. She's founder and director of the Institute of Anti-Racism and Black Studies. Eben, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, and thanks for doing this interview.
Not at all. I have to say that the issue with To Kill a Mockingbird has come up in Ireland quite frequently in the last few years, and I reread it because I like tens of thousands of other people across the country read it, I think, when I was in second or third year, and it was only on rereading that it refreshed my memory as to the rampant racism and racial slurs in the book, which I, because I'm riven with white privilege, didn't remember. I remember the basic narrative of the story, but not the language used. And the language and that narrative are both key points of contention.
Yes, I mean, and that's it, you know. So imagine how long it takes you to remember what it is. The thing with this thing is racism. We keep wondering, now, how does it keep spreading? Because no parents really take their kids aside and say, here, this is how to be a racist. But our books, our education system, the things we're learning, and we're refusing to change, we're learning it from them. At such a tender age, people have been, you know, they are given this material. There's no reflective exercise in it. If it was a master's program, and you took To Kill a Mockingbird or Of Mice and Men, and you put it together, they read it, and then they analyzed it, we would say, okay, it's a learning tool. But that's not what they do. The kids are just permitted to use the N-word. They read those stories and they walk away. You know, with your white privilege, you're protected from seeing the shame. Yeah. But as a black person, you're surrounded with that shame. You're painted that this is your future, this is who you are. And our whole system doesn't have a single black studies or Africana studies that actually teaches people the real African identity. So you have young people stuck with this identity. Do you understand? It's horrible. It's horrible. And I tell you, it is unfair that people still continue to use these materials. We have cried out. I wrote an article about it last year. If you're teaching students, you're teaching people, and people you're teaching are saying, this is the impact what your materials you're using is having on us, and we refuse to change it, that is what we call bullying. When you say to somebody that you're doing something, and I'm saying, I don't like it, it is impacting on me negatively, and you keep on insisting on doing it, then you have become a bully. That's for me, that's just, it's as simple as that. When you're saying, I have the power not to change it, and I choose not to change it.
So it seems, and I would imagine that these particular pillar problems might apply to several other books on the curriculum. I don't have the curriculum in front of me, so I'm just going to focus on To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men. So there's the issue of the language in terms of racial slurs. There's that so-called, you know, white saviour narrative. There's the issue of the effect on any students of colour in the classroom that use of and hearing that kind of language may have on them. And there is the way in which tools of analysis are applied or not to the teaching of those books.
Yes, and if you look at it, if you look at our education system, it's only this year a very few teacher education system actually begin to teach teachers how to talk about race. So most of our teachers in school, they are very scared of talking about the subject of race. So they are not equipped. They've not been equipped to bring such a sensitive matter to young minds. So in other words, what they end up doing is you are exposing these young people to these materials without grounding them. So he said, our education system is our most trusted form of education, of knowledge. So if in a school I learn such things as the N-word in the classroom, I see the savior mentality being shared as a good thing, you know, then it prepares me to be that in the future. It prepares me to see people of color, people who are black, as less than myself. So that's how, when we talk about the system being racist, this is how we begin to teach it. We don't call people outside and teach them to be racist. No, the materials we teach, we use teach from. That's what, when we are talking about it, it's not because we can't ignore it. I don't care if you call me at the N-word. It doesn't make any difference to me. But you are actually teaching young white minds that this is the way to look at other people. So if in future they perform racism, am I going to blame the young kids? Absolutely not. I blame the education system. I never blame the kids. I always think that it's our education system that we should correct. And the fact that they are refusing to do anything about it, it is very sad.
Do you find even that the curriculum at second level is particularly homogenous? It tends only to represent one way of life, one ethnicity.
Yeah, because don't forget that, you know, these books, for example, I think of Mice and Men, one of them was written in 1937. In 1937, they were not expecting black people to be in the classrooms. 1937, they were not expecting black people in the classroom. In 1960, when the other one was written, they were not expecting black people to be in the classroom. So these books were written for a time where white, you know, the classroom was expected to be all white. You know, when you're in an all-white school, people can crack jokes about black people and feel nothing. But now you have black people in the classroom. And we are still carrying on our education system as if we still have a homogeneous classroom, which we don't anymore. You can go to some areas, maybe like D4, I don't know. You might go to maybe D4 and maybe everybody's white, or Dunleary, or some places like that, and only the white, one white straight kid. But if you go to Lucan, or if you go to Tala, you know, there are black kids in the classroom. And every child is important. We keep talking about the value of a child. But when we continue to teach from this material, we are beginning to show them that not every child is equally important.
Arguably, it shouldn't really matter whether or not there are students of colour, children of colour in the classroom when you're selecting the curriculum and delivering it.
Absolutely. Because I keep saying something, that our lack of an integrated curriculum disadvantages not just the black kids, but our white children. Because when our white kids go to America after they graduate, or they go to the UK, or they go to Australia to go and live and work, they will be shocked when they get to America that the three line managers above them are black. Because here in Ireland, the only thing black people are for, cleaners and putting the bins out. So they get to the United States. Am I echoing?
Are you echoing? No.
Okay.
It's a lovely clear line.
Oh, perfect. I was echoing back to myself. when they get to the United States and they are shocked that the three line managers are ahead of them are all black people. You know, we look at the racism in the United States and we say, oh, it's really terrible. I say, not half as terrible as the one we have here in Ireland. We can't even navigate the labor market. We can't navigate it. Go to the United States. Every rank, up from bottom to the top, there are black people in every rank. And that's why there is a lot of racial tension. Not because there is more, but because, you know, black people are occupying every position. So there is opportunity for clashes. In Ireland, it's only at the bottom that there is opportunity for clashes. Get to the middle, it's very white. Get to the top, it's very white. So you look at the people deciding our curriculum. It's very, very white. You know, so there's no sensitivity, no cultural sensitivity, no consciousness of the impact. And not just the impact on the black person, like you said, but on our own white minds. I teach black studies, and there's a book I use. It's a book by Kataji Woodson. It calls it the Miseducation of the Negro Person. You know, and when I finished the book, I actually said, he encourages that black people should learn their history. But when I finished the book, I said, actually, no. Black and white people should learn black history, because the history of Africa is the history of the world. And when we miss that out in our history, we get a half-sided, a lopsided education system. We have to know the things Africa has contributed to the world, so we can have a reasonable relationship with people. There are good books out there. I mean, people, if you want literature, Maya Angelou, Audre Lorde, you know, Ibrahim X. Kendi is a new person who is even just there writing about anti-racist babies. So if you're looking for a book or literature, you know, on racism, just some of those books. I mean, Maya Angelou has done poetry for the president. So what do we want?
Well,
so why are we insisting?
Well, Dr. Eben Joseph, founder and director of the Institute of Anti-Racism and Black Studies, thank you indeed for joining us there. Now, as you've been hearing on our news bulletins today and indeed last night, Minister of State Josepha Madigan told the Dáil last night that she is a survivor of sexual assault. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
I have to say at the outset, a very brave, very courageous statement made by Minister Josepha Madigan in the Dáil last night. And as she has noted herself, she's one of tens of thousands of women across the country that have experienced this.
Yeah, I think it was a very important statement, because she was talking about something personal. And, you know, at her level, she knows she gets abuse for anything she says along the way. It seems to me she's getting a lot more support on this one than any abuse, although undoubtedly that will come. But to actually leave herself open by making a personal statement did say something. But I think it said something very important for the rest of us as well. She is clear that this was abuse that was done to her, that she experienced. She is not to blame. She is not to be ashamed about it. She may want to move on, but she's naming it in the context of all the other people, all the other women in the Oireachtas, she mentioned specifically, but all the other people as well that have experienced it, and that in order to fix the problem, we first of all have to name it and we have to talk about it. And you know, she was able to make that link between herself and saying that this was not, she was not unusual. She was almost normal in experiencing this abuse and not talking about it before. But we're not, that's not solving the size of the problem. And she was talking about it in the context of the Citizens' Assembly, because they have made recommendations. They've said that gender equality can't happen for as long as we have violence that happens because of a person's gender, you know. So just, we can't actually have an equal society. And she was saying, let's bring those recommendations into the Oireachtas, let's deal with them, let's make the reforms that we need. So I think it was a very helpful statement, because for anyone who feels it's just me, or nobody will want to hear about this, she has made waves with this statement. She has identified that it happened to her, but also she's identified that it happens to so many others, and that is why she made it, is to reduce and hopefully eliminate that kind of abuse into the future.
Because I think that you can never really overstate the vast and pervasive prevalence of sexual violence in any given society. And statements by women of Josepha Madigan's note to the effect that they have experienced that as well are enormously powerful, because I still think in the back of some people's minds, Nolene, that sexual violence is only perpetrated by people who lurk around down dark and dank lanes wearing balaclavas.
Yeah, and she was very specific about that as well, and I thought that was helpful, that she said, you know, this happens in your home with your friends in your, you know, in your own places as well. I think that's right. And I think the other thing that people often think is it only happens by them, to them, not us, whoever us is.
Yeah.
That we're kind of great. I used to have a relation who used to say, thank God we're normal, meaning her immediate family, you know.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a normal enough reaction too, was to kind of say, this wouldn't be me. So just her statement did show that it cut across. She's educated. She is now part of the country's political elite.
Mm.
She is a member of an established party, and it happened to her. And she was a lawyer as well, which is the other thing, you know, that like is clear that she was a family lawyer and is. So she understands from that perspective as well what it means to say sexual abuse can happen in the home, for instance. So for her to say it, you're right, it is a powerful reminder about how this is, for all of us, a problem for all of us to solve, because it is highly pervasive throughout our society. I think she said that she would guess that almost anyone of her age, and indeed I think she could probably have said anyone of any age. Any woman of any age could have equally have said what she had to say about it. But I think the way she said it was thoughtful. It's in the context of we put up with it for all sorts of reasons, and she named some of them: shame, wanting to get on with your own life, feeling that it shouldn't have happened to you, all of those. But we cannot get on as a society unless people are prepared to say, frankly, this too was is something that I know happened. You don't have to say it about yourself, but you have to recognise that it is a widely pervasive ill in our society. It's a pernicious, vivid and a sort of prevalent form of harm which has actually been able to spread because we didn't talk about it, because it was so hidden.
And that talking is absolutely vital, because I know the minister noted to that her age, and you've also noted that any age group can be affected and is affected by the corrosive
yes.
poison of sexual violence. But what we're talking about here, Nolene and I, is the people of all genders on whom sexual violence is inflicted, and yet the people who are inflicting it remain in the shadows.
Yeah. And so amongst the recommendations that the Citizens Assembly make is they do say make the judicial system simpler, but they say, first of all, in terms of how you deal with that, is we're going to have to take a number of steps at the same time, and some of them are absolutely missing. I mean, the Department of Education has to be called out on this one. It's now a good 2 years since the National Council for Curriculum Assessment identified the recommendations that needed to be put in place to have a good programme of sexual education and healthy relationships education in our schools, because we need young people to have the kind of language that they need in order to identify where they might be at risk of harm, of being harmed, or risk doing harm. So that hasn't been put in place yet. And then in general society as well, we're still not at that place where people are comfortable calling it out.
Mm.
If they see sexual abuse in the workplace, you know, people still kind of say it's a problem for HR, let's turn away from it. If a group of people say, well, we were only doing it for fun, we didn't mean any harm.
Yeah, I never understand why we continue to allow, and I mean we as in all of us,
yes.
each and every one of us continue to allow, that kind of usher, it's only a joke, it's only a laugh, why are you getting all het up? Stop being so
yeah.
sensitive. And then on the more grave side of that coin, we have people still writing character references for people who are convicted of often grave crimes of sexual violence ahead of their sentencing.
Yeah. And so just going back to the other bit, the bit about how we still allow it to happen, I think here a part of that as well is also, and I'll end up learning off Minister Madigan's speech by heart because it sums up pretty well everything that I need to say from time to time as well. But one of the things she mentioned specifically was the traumatic impact of these incidents. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not constant, if it's not every night, if it's not domestic violence, if it's just incidents from time to time, it has a traumatic impact. And I don't know that we have ever heard properly from people who've experienced that impact about how deeply it cuts into yourself and how it can be so damaging, particularly if you don't get attention for it. If you're kind of encouraged to stay quiet, or you feel you must stay quiet, and you don't get attention for it and don't deal with it, you are impeding yourself, you are handicapping yourself in your life going forward. And I think we don't take enough time to think that sexual violence, sexual abuse is very often about the internal impact, the impact to a person's dignity, that somebody would assault somebody in their most private places that are their own. You know, we tend not to focus in on that, and that's why people can maybe, I think, treat it casually, because surely if we understood how serious the injury was, we wouldn't tolerate it. And then, as you say, at the other end, there was, but I think it is easing a little bit. There definitely was that societal push that said, don't interfere with this person, actually normally male, who has a good career, who has good prospects in life. And if you tell on them, you'll damage their prospects into the future. That was a way in which our society, our faith systems, our laws did not recognize the illegality of sexual assault, including rape. And and so that has to change.
Well, Nolene, unfortunately, time is against us, but thank you as always for being so generous with your time. That's Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And if you need to make contact with a DRCC, you can do so on the National 24-Hour Helpline, 1800 77 88 88. Right, because it seems we can't have nice and simple things, there's now a question mark over testing requirements for children in the context of the EU digital COVID cert, which Ireland is, of course, virtually paddy-last in implementing. To talk us through this quagmire, joined on the line now by none other than Strafford's Owen Curry. He's editor of Air and Travel magazine. Owen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. It's a pleasure.
What's happening now?
Well, this much we know. 26 of the 27 countries implemented this last Friday, and it's working. It's been working really well right across Europe, even in places we didn't expect it to work immediately. East of the Alps is working really well, almost better than some of the countries west of the Alps. And we also know that the officials in Ireland are saying that it will be ready to roll. They will have it up and running by July the 19th. As of Monday, people who are registered on the HSE portal will be getting emails that link you to a site that you can download the digital COVID certificate and the Crucial QR code. The politicians are less optimistic. They've been making noises saying it's going to be messy, there's going to be queues at the airport, and some of the front pages of the papers today had different dates that it would be implemented. We had 2 August and a September in some of the Sunday newspapers. But the officials think it's ready to go and will be ready. If you've been vaccinated by a GP, it's a little bit more complicated because, as listeners will have heard in your show and others, the data from GPs has been slower feeding back to the central database, but they will be getting a letter. And then July the 19th, the ban on all but essential travel comes to an end. Irish people can travel again. And the other thing that you alluded to in your intro comes into play. The people who are not through the full course of vaccination, and the people who are over the children, people who are over the age of 6, because the Irish regulation is under the age of 6 the test regulations do not apply, or the vaccination regulations. Other countries, most other countries, the key countries that we go on holidays to, Spain and Portugal, it's 12. But there is that fuzzy bit in the middle, and a lot of questions about that, Ciara.
But here's the thing, how are the rest of Europe managing this smaller children problem, if you will? Because I don't think there's widespread vaccination of children anywhere across Europe.
Not at all, but it's antigen testing that is required for children to travel across Europe. And that is the case of all the major countries that we go to. Anyone travelling out to Spain and Portugal, if they're not just children, but the middle cohort of vaccinated between the age of 12 and the age that are vaccinated, they're going to require a test still. And that will be antigen outbound and PCR inbound.
That's very expensive.
PCR inbound is quite, can be, the PCR is more, it's less expensive abroad than it is here. But if you're, you know, what we're charging into Ireland is, there's two main operators, Rockdoc, €95, and Randox, €90 operating at the airport, and a family of four that can add up. But that's the PCR that both Spain and Portugal have moved from PCR to antigen in the last month. And they will still require people who aren't through the full course of vaccination to have a test.
What is the view, Owen, in your virtual travels around Europe, if not your literal, of Ireland's lagging so far behind in the implementation of this cert?
Really interesting, Ciara, because it didn't make much of an impact at all. Everybody was locked down. There was sort of this Rubik's Cube of 27 different countries with different regulations. Everybody knew we were a little bit, you know, more cautious. And then it changed. And like all these things, it's hard to put. I've been out of the country a bit on the sense of travel. I've been in Madrid for the Pedro Sanchez's announcement that Spain would be reopening on June the 7th, for instance. And you could sense that everything had changed, that mandatory hotel quarantine had got widely reported across Europe. And in America, newspapers like the Wall Street Journal were picking up the targeting of American tourists and having being described as disease spreaders. So when Tourism Ireland do a lot of it, they're researching monthly to see how our perception is internationally. They were tracking that we were doing really well right through to January, February. But we slid way down the rankings in the last 3 weeks. And two things are going on there. First of all, the European Commission has made it quite clear that 26 or 27 countries have introduced this. Ireland is the one dragging its feet. And the coverage, the negative coverage of particular incidents out of mandatory hotel quarantine, mothers being pulled away from their families, and the memes that were paraded across the internet, you know, very misogynistic anti-woman memes. And that's been picked up quite a bit across Europe. So they are, we're seeing our competitors, like Scotland would be a place that tourists go to that wouldn't be that different from Ireland, keeping their reputation while Ireland is sliding down the rankings. Another problem is the outdoor dining thing has got a little bit more coverage than it would have. So while we were one of the bunch, Ciara, there wasn't that big a problem. Now it's becoming clear that we're behaving a bit differently from the rest of Europe, and the research is showing up that we're falling down the rankings. Not permanent damage, but it's very worrying. There's another thing happening. It only happened over the last 2 weeks, and it happened especially last weekend, that Aer Lingus slashed their schedule. They have cut all their all of the North American services, apart from the three core ones of Chicago, Boston, and New York. People who are booked in those services are getting emails, either just giving them their money back because they can't be accommodated, or offering them alternatives. And a lot of the European schedule is gone. Ryanair has kept its schedule, but Aer Lingus has seemed to have been withdrawn from the battlefield. And what's interesting...
Oh, and unfortunately, time is against us. The tempest fugit, and the news won't wait for us. Thank you, as always, for your time. That's Strathan's own Owen Curry, editor at Air and Travel magazine. My thanks to you all for your company.